Once again for Dialogue Conspiracy with Political allegedly maintains by force its control over the legislative, executive, and judicial processes in America. And now, Mae Brussel.
Good afternoon. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California. A nice, wet, sunny day. We've wanted to rain for a long time. This is Mae Brussel. I have to repeat that, for the mixer two wasn't on. This is Carmel, California. It's February the 21st, 1977. Dialogue Conspiracy number 257. Last week I talked a little bit about WBAI FM radio station going off in New York City. It's a large radio station. It's described in the New York Times as the most iconoclastic radio station in New York and also in the United States. There's been a dispute between the management and staff. This is part of the Pacifica Network, the chain they have, KPFA in Berkeley, KPFK in Los Angeles, and a station in Houston, Texas. But this is the station that I'm most familiar with because I've been on that station many, many times with Bob Fass and Lindsay Auden and Ted Gandolfo, who's called in. We've done shows together there, and I've had Dialogue Conspiracy on the air back in New York for a length of time, and the people back there got used to this kind of news broadcast, which they don't get from the other stations. It seemed that the information I was getting into was just too heavy, particularly for New York City, when I was back there several times at the Elgin Theater, and a new station manager was brought in last December, Pablo Uribe Guzman, former minister of the Young Lords, and he immediately became program director of this station, and Anna Kossoff became the station manager. The station hands took over and set up a confrontation between Mark Lane, the researcher, and myself, with Ted trying to get information in between to them on the importance of opening up the investigations in Washington, D.C. And we were all cut off the air, and it seems that Anna Kossoff and Mr. Guzman were brought in there for the express purpose of silencing Dialogue Conspiracy or information into these various assassinations. What they're trying to do back there now, what they try to do is to change the commentaries, particularly Bob Fass's show, which is on from Thursday through Sunday, all night, from midnight till 5 in the morning, to popular music. And what they said they wanted, Mr. Guzman said, was light talk shows. Light, of course, being defined, not talking about Howard Hughes or the hoax, the fact that a man named Vance Cooper or Wayne Rector could be buried in Houston, Texas, and not Howard Hughes at all. I believe that was the start of the problems of BAI, with my information on the air, was making the allegations that Howard Hughes is not buried in Houston, Texas, and this is one more hoax on the American people, another multi-billion-dollar hoax, I might add. But the station is now off the air because when they canceled these shows about the assassinations or Dialogue Conspiracy, the listeners were already used to my programming, and they called in and kept heckling the station, yet the station, it seems, had orders and decided not to have me on with this information. And then the listeners said, if this is a listener-sponsored station, you're a bunch of phonies, and we're not going to send our money. And the subscriptions dropped off so radically, new management came in, and it will be an impossibility for them to raise funds as they did before. They have to either be funded outright by people like the Ford Foundation or the Rockefellers, whoever puts up a big bulk of their money, but they can't appeal to the public at large and put on that cover anymore because the public will not come forward with the money because they know that the news is being suppressed. Now, this is important to me because there's a woman newscaster in Modesto, California, named Carol Benson, and I've done many, many shows with her. And when I went up to do a show with her last spring on Howard Hughes, rather in the fall of this year, there was a gentleman that asked to come and sit in the room with us. He had flown in from Hawaii. And shortly after that time, Carol was told that by January, we were together around September, October, by January her talk shows would be over and they would switch to country western music. This is terribly important because in lazy little towns like Santa Barbara, Fresno, Modesto, the heart of America, the farmland area, people are cut off from programs like Dialogue Conspiracy and the facts that are different than what you're network news is telling you. So immediately when these shows are promoted and people begin to get interested in this information, the shows are canceled, and that's one example. Another example was the way that my appearances on KGO were drastically and very quickly cut off after I began to talk about Sarah Moore working with the FBI and the Treasury Department. She's the woman who was supposed to have shot Gerald Ford, and she has high connections up in the Republican Party and with the intelligence agencies, and is in counterintelligence, and she'll be paroled within a short time. I don't believe she'll be in jail for a lifetime. She'll be a model prisoner and be out soon. But as soon as these programs were on KGO and I was talking about these things, each of the newscasters became terrified, and I've not been allowed to have any length of time except to call in and give an occasional question. This happened at WBUR in Boston, and as I say, WBAI in New York. And now we again have to think about KLRB. It has been sold. I've never met the new managers, and right now I'm coming to the idea that I'll try and get a newsletter out and published in case the radio stations in this country are cut off and the network of getting to the people is cut off. Then the other avenue of communications, if it's possible, is through a probably 10-page newsletter every 2 weeks with a summary of news that I have on KLRB, which I hope will continue, or if it doesn't continue, we'll send it out through a newsletter. But I'm working on that now and trying to see as an alternative means of still getting information to the people. Last week on Dialogue Conspiracy, I talked about the congressional committee that was falling apart. The House of Representatives selected a panel of persons to investigate the killing of the Reverend Martin Luther King and the assassination of President John Kennedy. This should have been the ideal dream of researchers like myself who spent 13 years just on the John Kennedy assassination investigating it. But it's been a nightmare for me to think of the people who want to investigate it and the conflicts going on. The news media has always ignored the evidence of a conspiracy or the hard evidence, and they give you the front page. If the Justice Department said there was no conspiracy to kill Martin Luther King, that gets the front page headlines. But the clause that says the conspiracy can't be ruled out because they don't know where James Earl Ray got the money is at the back of the sentence, and the headlines say no conspiracy. Now that Richard Sprague, the counsel for the committee, has been fighting with Congressman Henry Gonzalez about the committee, the fight makes the front pages and the infighting makes the news, and the major news media love it. Oliphant had a cartoon this Sunday's paper called Oliphant Looks at Congress. He's got a picture about 14 congressmen knocking each other over, and one has a chair in his hand and one has a desk on his head, and one has fallen over another chair and the picture frame's coming down on somebody's head. And below it, it says, pardon me, is this the offices of the House Assassinations Committee? And one takes time out to say, nice shot. They're poking each other. And in the left, it said, on-the-job training, we call it. So now that they are having this great infighting, the committee makes the news as it sinks deeply into non-existence, literally non-existence, the infighting becomes newsworthy. Right now, as we're doing this show on KLRB, a Dialogue Conspiracy, the men in Washington, Congressman Gonzalez and Richard Sprague and the committee have met on Monday, even though it's a holiday, to decide what to do with the committee. Congressman Gonzalez wants to fire Richard Sprague, the attorney, and Richard Sprague has the support of 11 members of the committee that he should stay on, and it won't be workable either way now, so it should be shelved. And the sabotage of the investigation worked very well. At the time of the Rules Committee hearings, I have the minutes of the Rules Committee hearing in January, just 2 weeks ago, January 25th, 1977, and Ted Gandolfo supplied these to me. He gives me day-to-day information from Washington, exactly what's going on, and he gets special delivery, the minutes of these, because they're not in the congressional record. And at this meeting, January 25th, they talked about Richard Sprague and what to do with him. And Mr. Lott, a member of Congress, said, your committee counsel has become one of the issues of whether or not they should continue the investigation. I think you have a real problem here. Many people, particularly the specialized counsel, came to Washington, and they don't understand what their role is supposed to be. When people come to Washington, D.C., like Richard Sprague, he said, they suppress what their role is supposed to be. And we don't tell them what the role is until it is too late. I think your counsel, Mr. Sprague, has become a major if not one of the issues of the whole proceedings. It is going to be very difficult for you to proceed with him as your counsel. You have a major issue here, and you should deal with it. Congressman Gonzalez said, I come from bronco-busting territory. We will ride that bronco. Henry Gonzalez is from Texas. Mr. Lott said, make sure you get off the bronco before he throws you. Representative Clausen from California said, Henry, I'm from the Southwest. Once in a while, you find a horse that cannot be broken, even with the best of bronco busters. Henry Gonzalez said, I don't believe in shooting them. And Mr. Lott says, sometimes it is an act of mercy. Now, that is the dialogue of men in the Rules Committee, how you get rid of somebody that's giving you a lot of trouble. You can take it whichever way you want. Is it a figure of speech or is it literally? You can have it any way you want, but they suggested, Gonzalez said, I don't believe in shooting them, and Lott said, sometimes it is an act of mercy. Now, how far does that attitude extend about whether or not a person should live or die, and how many people in this country are going to live or die on decisions that are just figures of speeches? Remember at the time of Watergate when Jeb Magruder was talking to G. Gordon Liddy about shooting Jack Anderson or killing Jack Anderson, and he took it literally and was on the way out the hall to shoot him and was just stopped and didn't think anything wrong with it. He thought that's what he was supposed to do. Well, the next few weeks on Dialogue Conspiracy, I'm going to be talking about 30 or 40 or 50 deaths that I think have been taking place as a part of this deep counterintelligence control of planet Earth by a given set of people. We've talked about those people the last few weeks, the Trilateral Commission, the Bilderbergers, the Rockefeller Combine with the CIA, and the same people that put Hitler into power, the links of Richard Nixon and his law office to the Nazis that came to this country. So I think we'll bring up Dialogue Conspiracy up to date for the next 3 or 4 weeks, as I say, with 30 or 40 deaths that I think are terribly suspicious. And when you take them individually, they don't look so much, but when you take them separately, not much, but when you put them all together, they mean a lot, and particularly when you take them and put them against other deaths and the way that other deaths happen. A typical example of this is headlines just yesterday and the day before in all of our newspapers, wire story services coming out of the famous Bob Woodward from the Washington Post, who helped through Deep Throat to bring Richard Nixon out of office. He has a new headline called New CIA Payoffs Hinted that Jimmy Carter is investigating. And one of the payoffs is King Hussein, one of the world leaders who received approximately $1 million annually since the late 1960s. In the book, The Cult of Intelligence, Victor Marchetti and John Marks named King Hussein as a recipient of millions of dollars, but this case went to court and it was deleted from their book and couldn't be published. Therefore, many people in Washington knew about King Hussein, and the question is, when do you bring the time bomb and who do you bring it down? Gerald Ford knew about this money and kept it quiet. They're putting it on Carter's shoulders now. Well, the story's been around for a long time, but it just broke this week, the week of February the 19th, 1977. Just 2 weeks before the story broke, or 11 days before the story broke, the death of Queen Aliya of Jordan took place, the queen of King Hussein, the recipient of $1 million a year. She died just days before the story was to break, 11 days before. Then-Secretary Cyrus Vance was sent directly to Jordan to assure the United States that Hussein did great favors for and that money in exchange for it, that it was well spent. Why was the story breaking at this time? Was Jimmy Carter wanting d'entente with the Middle East? Was he going to make peace with Jordan and Israel? And is this one more example of keeping the Middle East and Israel fighting each other with America in the middle? Remember the story of the U-2 flight breaking when Eisenhower was in office in 1959, 1960, and broke up the peace conference, and that was arranged by the CIA. And Mr. Thu, who's one of the recipients of these millions of dollars in this new expose, has bragged how he won the election for Richard Nixon, and he had worked with Madame Chenault against Lyndon Johnson, who wanted the peace in 1967, 68, and kept it going till Richard Nixon could bring it about. So here we have again a case of CIA money exposures coming out just at a time when Jimmy Carter wants some peace. Well, who was Queen Aliya of Jordan? Why would her plane go down, and what role did she play in this? and I've compared her to the plane crash of Dorothy Hunt at the time of the height of Watergate, just when the scandal was breaking that E. Howard Hunt was a conduit of millions of dollars for the CIA, and that his wife was the bag woman. The plane went down, and Dorothy Hunt was killed. Well, the sources of my information about Queen Aliyah of Jordan come from three newspapers so far, the Las Vegas Sun, the New York Times, and the Washington Post. But from these newspapers, this is the profile I get from her. She was the third wife of King Hussein, and she was killed, as I say, February the 9th, 1977, on Wednesday, along with the Jordanian Minister of Health, Mohammed al-Bashir. Tuesday, the day before she was killed, the day before her death, King Hussein met with UN Secretary General Kurt Waldheim on projects for Arab-Israeli peace talks, which now allegedly may be put off or stalled. At the time, just before her death, while she's away visiting a hospital in southern Jordan, the head of the UN, the UN Secretary General, is in Jordan with King Hussein. The Washington Post is about to break the story about the CIA money, and Cyrus Vance is expedited immediately to Jordan when the story breaks. And Ali, his wife, Aliyah, was sent to a hospital to inspect the hospital. This queen came from a distinguished Palestinian family from the West Bank. She is useful to King Jordan, the King of Jordan, it's explained, because her home is now under Israeli occupation. So you can imagine how favorable she would be to a peace conference with Israel. She graduated from the Hunter College in New York City. She studied political science and psychology. She worked for the Royal Jordanian Airlines as a public relations hostess. And I think at the time of Watergate and the Lewis Tackwood allegations and the Howard Hughes escapades of public relations, 9 times out of 10 was a cover specifically for CIA activities. So when Hussein was married to another woman, she was working as a public relations hostess at Jordanian Airlines. And there she was called the Westernized Queen. Her marriage to Hussein was interpreted, this is from the New York Times, as a political move by King Hussein because of her influence among the West Bank Palestinians. Some who knew the couple said their marriage was as much a love match as a marriage of convenience. But both articles that I read on this particular marriage called it a political move and a marriage of convenience. Now, if political moves and conveniences can be made, they can be broken, too, at the same time. And she obviously had to be a source of contact through her firms and through her constant traveling and escapades for this CIA money going to King Hussein. He openly courted her while he was still married to his second wife and had decided that he would take this woman as his third wife, and the second marriage was dissolved. She was born in Egypt. She lived in Turkey, England, United States, and Italy. She also worked as a typist, which is an interesting job, in the American Express travel section of New York, as well as in the public relations of the airlines. These are interesting occupations for a political move, what is called a political move by the king, to take a typist from the American Express and a secretary from a public relations firm for an airlines. With her international background, her public relations work, and millions of dollars coming to King Hussein from the CIA, it could be easy to guess that Queen Aliyah was possibly the bag woman for the intelligence operations in the Middle East. You remember the Sirhan family, the famous Sirhan family that was brought over here from Jordan and Palestine to Pasadena. I've done shows on KLRB about their coming to this country and wrote an article for Midnight Magazine on the links to Richard Nixon's law office in Whittier to the Sirhan family. And when they were arrested in this country, when Sirhan Sirhan was arrested on charges of killing Robert Kennedy, their family was non-existent in the Jordanian embassy. They were brought in by the Greek Orthodox Church, which is a CIA conduit. And recently we have a new book on the law office of Richard Nixon being used for a Nazi front and for the Odessa, a gentleman that worked internationally with the Odessa who came here from Romania, Mr. Maloxa. So this plane goes down and, as I say, is at the height of a scandal, of a CIA scandal, just like Dorothy Hunt's plane went down at the height of the Watergate scandal. And I believe that you could say that she would be a casualty of this particular moment. The Earth News last week, February the 11th, 1977, had an article on how federal agencies get their jobs, and it had to do with Alexander Butterfield. And this again goes into the Dorothy Hunt plane crash It said Alexander Butterfield, who worked in the White House and who was famous for taping President Nixon and responsible for telling about the tape system that got Nixon out of office, got his job, according to a Senate study, by a phone call from John Ehrlichman telling him that he should go as head of Federal Aviation Post. Butterfield, according to Earth News, a command pilot with 20 years' experience in the Air Force, said that while he was talking to John Ehrlichman about his new job for the FAA, he had to get out a little copy of a government manual to see what were the functions of the FAA. He had no knowledge of the job, he lacked knowledge of the job, and he went through with the appointment anyway. But what the Earth News didn't say, or what the study of Jim Graham didn't say, he's the author of a Senate study on how federal agents get their jobs, what they didn't say was that the day after Dorothy Hunt's plane crash went down and she was bagwoman for the CIA, Egil Krogh, he was the head of the White House plumbers and had hired E. Howard Hunt and G. Gordon Liddy, and Dorothy Hunt was a bagwoman for them. Egil Krogh left immediately from his job in the White House as an aide to Richard Nixon to become undersecretary of the Department of Transportation, and that Alex Butterfield then went on to be head of Federal Aviation, but he went on the request of John Ehrlichman, and he went 1 week after Dorothy Hunt's plane crash, which confirms what I said about the crash with Dorothy Hunt being sabotaged, because I know that Egil Krogh and Alex Butterfield and Dwight Chapin did not have these jobs planned when the Hunt plane went down. Dwight Chapin was the appointment secretary for Richard Nixon, who was sent to Chicago within 5 weeks after the Hunt plane crash to be in charge of the United Airlines investigation of the crash. So Egil Krogh, who hired the White House plumbers, Alex Butterfield, the CIA man in the White House, and Dwight Chapin, the appointment secretary, got jobs at the Department of Transportation, the FAA, and the United Airlines. This is why I believe that this other bag woman, with her past profile of working in American espionage, was indeed shot down at a time that the story was breaking. Now, I'm going to say to go into a long list of deaths in addition to the wife of King Hussein. And I think the one that I want to talk about today, there's so many, is Freddie Prinze, the actor. And I mentioned that last week that I would talk about Freddie Prinze and then get into some of the other actors and writers and people that are being murdered, people working for the CIA. As introduction to my remarks on Freddie Prinze, I want to read 3 pages quickly of an article I did for We Magazine. This is an article which they asked me to do on the murder of the rock musicians, and they accepted it and told me when it arrived there, I'd worked 3 months on it, it was fine. Then they sent me a kill fee, and somebody above, Hugh Hefner or somebody above Terry Catchpole, canceled the article after they had accepted it. And of course, when you hear how it reads, and then you read about the succession of actors that are now being killed in Hollywood, Godfrey Cambridge and Freddie Prinze and Mr. Finch, you can see what's going on in Hollywood, just like with the rock musician scene. What I had said, and this applies to musicians, is that American and British pop rock music during the 60s created an art form described as one of the most important cultural revolutions in American history. Within a few years, between 1968 and 1976, many of the most famous names associated with this early movement were dead. Mama Cass Elliot of the Mamas and Papas, Jimi Hendrix, Otis Redding, Brian Jones, who helped form the Rolling Stones with Mick Jagger and Keith Richards, Janis Joplin, Dwayne Allman, Barry Oakley, who helped form the Allman Group, and Dwayne Allman is the brother of Greg Allman, Tim Buckley, Jim Croce, Richard Farina, Donald Rex Jackson, road manager for the Grateful Dead, Michael Jeffrey, Jimi Hendrix personal manager, Brian Epstein, Beatles manager, Al Jackson, drummer for Wilson Pickett, backup drummer for Otis Redding, Vinnie Taylor, the Sha-Na-Na, Paul Williams, the choreographer, The Temptations, Clarence White from The Byrds, Robbie McIntosh, drummer for The Average White Band, Jim Morrison of The Doors, Pamela Morrison, Jim's wife, Rod McCurran, Pigpen of The Grateful Dead, Phil Oakes, Graham Parsons, who helped found The Byrds and Flying Burritos and sang with Emmylou Harris, Sal Mineo, Meredith Hunter, he's the victim of the killing at Altamont Festival, Steve Parent, leading singer of Children, who wrote one of their top songs for ZZ Top, and Jimmy Reed and many others were possible victims of murder. Their family and friends accepted the musician's depressions or accidents of having to do with alcohol, drug usage, or both. Was anything added to their beverages or drugs to cause personality changes and eventual suicides? Almost every death was shrouded with unanswered questions and mysteries. Persons around the musicians had strange backgrounds and were often suspect. All of these musicians were at the peak of a creative period at the time they were offered LSD. These were in the late 60s that this was all happening. Their personalities altered drastically. Optimism and gratification over their success were suddenly replaced with doubt and misery. Why would people with so much talent and influence as Phil Oakes, Janis Joplin, Graham Parsons, Jim Morrison, Brian Jones be wallowing in self-doubt or despondency? They were loved. They were doing important work. They were having concerts, compositions, cutting new records. Did Jimi Hendrix, Mama Cass, and Steve Perrin choke on their vomit? I doubt it. When Phil Oakes was traveling in Africa, some gentlemen grabbed up behind him and cut his throat. That affected his vocal cords and his singing. And what I went on to say, and I'll read more of this article later on KLRB, I said, was Lenny Bruce the first victim of this supposed overdosing and drugging? How about Jack Kerouac? Did Bruce pay his dues for comparing the United States police to Hitler's Gestapo? Were all the fuss about his words only a cover story? The 9 years in which these musicians allegedly overdosed, drank themselves to death, drove over cliffs, hung themselves, choked, crashed their motorcycles, went insane, or freaked out without any reasonable explanation were the same years that the FBI and CIA waged a large-scale domestic war against any kind of dissent. That was during the anti-war movement. And as soon as all of these major artists were all murdered and drugged and dead, then in came the mafia and another element into Hollywood that took over the music industry that now seems to be taking over the acting and television and the young people in those fields. Freddie Prinze was at the height of his career. He was making millions of dollars in contracts. The cover stories of his death were ridiculous, that he was obsessed with death, that he obsessed with the JFK murder, that he made too much money too soon. He actually was a political person in every sense of the word, just like the rock musicians that I just read off. First of all, he was an active Democrat. He didn't just go to the poll and vote, save for Jimmy Carter. He was at the Kennedy Gala the night before the inauguration. He was invited to the White House, one of the entertainers that had worked for Jimmy Carter. He represented a minority that's never heard of on major TV network, the Chicano, Puerto Rican, Latin type. He was interested in who killed John Kennedy. He played the Abraham Zapruder films of Kennedy's assassination over and over. Now, the interpretation of the news media is that he was consumed with death because he played this. I have a copy of the Zapruder films. I know other researchers who have copies. I know researchers that have seen that literally hundreds of times because it shows conclusively that John Kennedy was killed from the front and not from the back. And what Freddie Prinze was probably concerned about was who killed John Kennedy, not the fact that his head was blown off. And he was also concerned just before he died with the death of Lenny Bruce, according to a friend that was with him shortly before he died. He was concerned with Lenny Bruce and Marilyn Monroe and Gary Gilmore and what was happening to these people. Until very recently, he was happily married. But he married a woman, Kathy, that he hardly knew. It was a quick marriage at Las Vegas. The courtship was about as long as Lee Harvey Oswald dating Marina Oswald. It was hardly any time at all. He had a child that he adored, and then she evidently couldn't get along with him or the drugs that he was being fed and asked him to move out. And the cause for his suicide, one of the causes is supposed to be the fact that she was strict on the visiting hours or said he wasn't supporting her. The cause for killing John Kennedy was supposed to be that Oswald didn't see his wife the weekend before and came home and got a gun. The cover story is always those things, but his interest in these what are political murders like Lenny Bruce and Marilyn Monroe, or who killed John Kennedy, or supporting Jimmy Carter, or being active in the Chicano community and being a hero to these people and having made it, is a very good reason for knocking him out and killing him before he succeeds too far. He went to a psychiatrist named Dr. William Kroger, K-R-O-G-E-R, who works with the Los Angeles Police Department. He's skilled at hypnosis. He had hypnotized Freddie Prinze the night before he killed himself. He had been deep in hypnosis. He had taken a gun away from Prince, knowing that he wanted to kill himself, and then handed it back to him and let him keep the gun, knowing that he talked about and had been hypnotized. And Dr. Kroger has worked recently with the police departments regarding the Chowchilla kidnapping case. Another Chicano famous, a man was killed by the Los Angeles Police Department, Ruben Salazar. He was killed in an inn by Sheriff Peter Pitch's men during a May Day moratorium. He was inside of a bar, and they shot through and killed him and didn't call the ambulance until he was dead. He was a newspaper man, much loved by the community, a Vietnam veteran, and probably the most famous spokesman for these people in public life outside of Freddie Prinze, and the same people that had killed the Ruben Salazar were working with this Dr. William Kruger, the psychiatrist who had hypnotized Freddie Prinze. The weapon that he had with him was taken from the doctor. He was supposed to be suicidal, but I think of the book, The Control of Candy Jones, who worked for the CIA, and she was hypnotized and told to kill herself. And the only thing that saved her was Long John Neville, her husband, and she now has a $1 billion lawsuit against the CIA. If Freddie Prinze's wife, Kathy, had tape-recorded conversations in bed or asleep or studied hypnotism and knew what was going on with his drugging and was alert as Long John Neville, the tables might be turned and they'd be suing the government. The gun, as I say, was taken away and it was handed back to him, and it was actually then used for the murder. Freddie Prinze was under hypnosis Wednesday, January 26, 1977, and he was under hypnosis January the 27th. His murder, I called a murder-suicide, came hours later. He took a lot of Quaaludes, which were downers, in addition to wine, and when he couldn't get them from the doctor, he went to Las Vegas, Nevada, an interesting place, to supply 100 Quaaludes, which were one of the things he was taking at the time he freaked out and killed himself. He knew he was going to die, identical to any kind of instructions or whatever he could have been told what to do. He took care of his will. He called his attorneys. He told everyone he was going to kill himself. He called his wife and told her he loved her, and she said she loved him, and then he shot himself. John J. Miller, writing in the San Francisco Chronicle, February the 13th, said Freddie Prinze was involved in mind-disorienting drugs. And these drugs, the story of his life, compares to many stories of these musicians I've studied. He took uppers, downers, and cocaine. He was left with a mental confusion that had little relationship to reality, and it had nothing to do with his life in New York. He took no liquor and no drugs when he was studying drama in New York, studied ballet and music and drums and guitar. But as soon as he got to Hollywood, where the organized crime drug syndicate had affected the music field, they affected the cinema too, and they hand out these drugs. Miller said the mystery of his pointless suicide is not really a mystery at all. He had $5 million worth of contracts on his manager's desk. But the real villain, it's not his ex-wife, it's a well-known comedian in Hollywood who kept telling Prinze over the last year that ups, downs, and cocaine would solve his problems. That fellow comic was both Freddie's confidant and his drug connection. He attended Prinze's funeral the night he was back hassling drugs for other friends in the media. Now, there is another article in the Las Vegas Sun that I take. It's written by Ralph Pearl, and it said, "Attention, Police Chief Ed Davis, Los Angeles. In case your department is still investigating the recent suicide of Freddie Prinze," which is interesting that a police department would be investigating a suicide, which I still am calling a murder. Ralph Pearl says he allegedly had been a regular user of meth cologne, better known as Quaaludes. A friend of his, visiting Freddie in his Beverly Hills home before he put an end to his life with a bullet in his brain, saw a bottle of Quaaludes in the medicine cabinet. It had his name on it and the name of the drug and the doctor who practices in Las Vegas. As you probably know already, Quaaludes are potent tranquilizers that have hallucinatory effects on the user, especially if they already have a case history of addiction. If you recall, Freddie raved and ranted and threatened to commit suicide many times during his last days on Earth. Prinze got those pills from the Las Vegas doctor while he was working at Caesar's Palace 3 weeks ago with Shirley MacLaine. We would have to conclude that mescaline that really and truly pushed Prinze over the edge. He was in Las Vegas doing a show at Caesar's Palace with Shirley MacLaine. 3 weeks later, he was in Washington, D.C. at the White House entertaining the president. And then he came back to Hollywood and went then to Las Vegas, where he picked up 100 Quaaludes, and his doctor had hypnotized him, and he was in the possession of the medicine and the gun, which they easily could have kept from him or kept a nurse or put him in a hospital. A lot of people have been suicidal, and they've been taken, even against their wishes, into a hospital. This is the same harassment that he got that Lenny Bruce had in Hollywood, going down the same path. As I say, 10 days before his death, he's entertaining Jimmy Carter, the new president. He's in the White House, and just before he went back there to the White House, was in November, he was arrested by the California Highway Patrol, and at that time he had a prescription. He was under the influence of drugs, and he was supposed to go to court on that in February, but the court case, according to his lawyer, didn't bother him. Now, Pete Hamill in New York City, the New York Post, New York Daily News, says that in New York City, Freddie Prinze worked hard on his career. He worked for the ballet and music companies. He was invited into the Jeffrey Ballet. He stayed clean. He didn't drink. He didn't take drugs. He worked at the High School of Performing Arts. It's when he got to Hollywood and began to play the part of the Chicano, the Puerto Rican, the Mexican, and became very popular on the air, that he began to get filled with drugs and become discredited. His agent, Ron D. Blasio, his personal manager, said that when he got to Hollywood, the army of agents, managers, producers fed off the creative talent of these people. They destroy the talent, they sell dope to celebrities, they sell them hard drugs. And his agent said, this is in the Daily News, New York Daily News, that these little runt agents are destroying talent. They sell the dope to celebrities. The hard drugs got started through Hollywood music industry in early 1970s. You see, the Freddie Prinze story continues where my story, The Rock Musician, leaves off, and I will have to do the whole thing on the air with you and get those printed soon, get them printed up. The Rock Musician scene was dope, LSD with poisons that caused permanent schizophrenia, suicide, and hallucinations. That was experimented by the CIA from about 1954 up to the present time. They have it. But they affected the whole music change of people in Hollywood and the music personalities. If you watched the Grammy Awards this last week, you know that the talent now wasn't the talent of the Monterey Pop. The Monterey Pop people are dead. The Beatles were broken up and discredited and linked to the Manson family through the title Helter Skelter of their song. The Aldemont scene broke up the Rolling Stones with Gimme Shelter, linking the kids and rock to violence through the help of LSD and hallucinations and murders. And the main musicians of the whole era are gone, the Otis Reddings, the Jimi Hendrix, the Janis Joplins. And all you have to do is listen to their music and see the movies on their lives to realize that this kind of talent isn't around. And I don't want to name the 10 worst people that are doing music that are at the top in Hollywood. You know who they are. I'm not going to name them. And they only got there because the top 30 were killed. And then what you're left is the next 20. And that's about what's coming out of the music industry now. And it's interesting that the agent, Freddie Prinze, makes a comparison and names the dates exactly how the Hollywood music industry in the early 70s, as I say, the Manson violence took place in 69 with the attempts to link it to the Beatles, and the Aldemont was in 69. And then in 70 came in the other drugs, not the LSD that they had used on the hippies, but the cocaine and the LSD plus the poisons, but marijuana with cocaine or heroin, cocaine with strychnine in it, and hallucinations caused by other drugs. And now the young talent in Hollywood are affected with it. They could be affected through hypnosis and drugs and collusion of the police department. There's a woman, Suzanne Martin, that met Prinze 3 weeks before his death, and he told her he wouldn't live till he was past 30. And a man like this, see, should be locked up. I know people who've been suicidal, and their family protected them and got nurses or put them in hospitals and got treatment. And he was telling everyone this, and they all knew he had a gun. He told Suzanne Martin that about Marilyn Monroe and Lenny Bruce, and talked about Gary Gilmore himself. 3 weeks before the inauguration, he was doing very well at Caesar's Palace, and in Washington, he was doing very well. But she said that he wanted her to go to Vegas to pick up Quaaludes, and that she wouldn't go with him. She said, Suzanne Martin said she refused to go because she knew the Quaaludes would kill him. And this is what Ralph Pearl writes in the Las Vegas Sun, that he went up to Vegas to get his murder, and that the murder is on the name of the bottle and the name of the doctor, and also I think the doctor in Hollywood should be charged for this. But this woman, once in a while there are some decent people, but she should have yelled a little louder. She said she refused to go with him because the Quaaludes would kill him, and she didn't go with him, and he came back with 100 Quaaludes, and last time she saw him, he was holding a gun, and that he had pointed it at her and was playing games, and she said, put it down, and he said, the safety pin is on, and when they looked at it, the safety pin wasn't on, and she said, I told Dr. Kroger about the gun, and I begged him to take it away from Freddie Prinze, and he did, and by Thursday night, Freddie Prinze had the gun back again by Dr. Kroger. Dr. Kroger said he'd come in the morning and take the gun away. He came to see Freddie, he left, and Freddie Prinze still had his gun. This is Pete Hamill writing in the New York Daily News. Freddie Prinze's last days were spent talking about death under hypnosis, filled with Quaaludes. He had all that he wanted, and everyone around him knew it, and there were suicide notes. Now, one suicide note in the apartment was written, the note that he left with two different pens. This was in the night news service. And then there was a P.S. added, which was written after he signed the original note, which indicated he had changed his mind on this, and there's no explanation of this note. There also was an interesting discrepancy in the weapons. There was a bullet hole, two bullet holes in the apartment, according to the police. One was in the hallway, which they said probably from a shot fired earlier when the gun may have discharged. His friend said that he did fire a gun to scare her, and he fell in the bathroom and played dead. And then there was another bullet hole found in the living room that was believed to have been caused by the bullet passing through Prinze's head. Now, that's not very good homicide investigative work, I don't believe, because the bullet, if it went through his head and went into the living room, should be available and identified as belonging to the bullet that he used, if it was in fact his gun. Maybe there were fingerprints on the gun that were not his. I don't know what the police department in Los Angeles did even investigate it, because one bullet hole was found in the living room and one was a hole in the hall, and there were these probablys to explain it. It probably was shot from his gun earlier. It may have been discharged while he was loading. The other bullet could have been caused by the bullet that went through his head. Now, it would be interesting to do some ballistic tests just on the chance that somebody else hadn't fired these bullets. Well, his agent, his friend, was there when he pulled the gun out and did shoot himself, but it would be interesting to just match the bullets and do a little more work on this case than I'm sure they're doing. Now, his, as I say, his assassination interest wasn't morbid at all. The cover story in the newspaper is that he had this morbid curiosity with death. I don't think people who watch the Abraham Zapruder film are morbid or want to consume themselves with dying themselves just because they want to know how John Kennedy died. The news media coverage of Freddie Prinze's death doesn't go into the doctors, the hypnosis, the Quaaludes, the destroying of his career. He also had two homes after he got married, and that's an interesting fact because I wonder if the people that got to him or could drug him got him when he was away from his wife. One home was in San Fernando Valley, and one was in Beverly Hills. And if people wanted to ruin his career or set him up and have him kill himself in order to show how all these other people were able to do it, and therefore those weren't murders like the rock musicians, and he was compared to them. Was he under the influence of people when he was away from Kathy, his wife? Who was around him when he got this disorienting drug experience that was fed to him so often? As I say, the news media coverage is typical. The headlines are, for example, United Press, Chico dies, no one to blame. A Star newspaper says, marriage breakup was the last straw for a sad, funny man. Time magazine says, too much, too soon. New York Times, Freddie's neighbors remember him. New York Times comes in with these great biographies. He was a chubby white kid that everybody used to beat up. The New York Daily News, last dark hours of Freddie Prinze's soul. I don't think any of these headlines are right unless we end up investigating the drug syndicate, the capturing of young talented musicians, the killing of particularly blacks and Chicanos, and these young successful people who are political forces who might open up the Marilyn Monroe murder, or the John Kennedy murder, or the Lenny Bruce murder. Unless we find out why these people are being killed, none of these headlines explain the story, and there's more in the cover-up of the headlines than behind the scenes. Well, our time is up on Dialogue Conspiracy. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel.